This is David Bowie inviting you to spend hours with me in the studio. This is David Bowie in the studio for the making of Young Americans and Station to Station. No, it isn't. Yeah,
there was a lot of love in the room last night.
It was really nice, wasn't it? I enjoyed it very much. Yeah, sitting here in the old armchair by the log fire.
Well, I told him, I said I felt like I was right home in Texas here. In Manhattan, the Longhorns out. The more I hear about this storytellers, the more you refer to it, the more it's referred to in the press, the more the staff is referred to it. I feel really left out. Doggone, I gotta see this thing. You must have done it.
I don't know what I did. Probably different to anything I've done before, in as much... I guess it's not having the imposition of a tour and not thinking that I've got to be presenting a very sleek and well-tailored show in quite the way that one normally thinks when you go out on tour. And so I literally just approached it as though I had a bunch of people in my... come over to the house and I was just playing through the songs and... kind of just telling little anecdotes and stupid things like that. But it seems to have expanded onto these promotional shows that we're doing for the album. We're not really doing a tour. I mean, we've done 3 gigs so far and we've got another 3 to do, and that's the end of our tour year. So 6 shows isn't exactly kind of overwhelming. So I've much treated it the same way. I don't really prepare a set list. I know the songs that we'll be picking during the course of the evening, and then I just go with it. And... if something occurs to me, I rather than editing, I just kind of say it, and things just bounce around the room. It's been a lot of fun. It really has, because it's an entirely different approach to doing a show for me, doing a lot of patter, banter, shtick. My business partner believes I'm becoming Shecky Green.
Well, I'm sure they love it, though, because we don't. There's been volumes written about your work for all these years, but we don't always get this kind of access, and I don't know if you noticed, but people have responded very well.
It's really odd, I must say. I think it's probably, I suppose, ever since I was first sort of publicly known, I think the one thing that just about the only thing that irritated me is that people presume that I didn't have a sense of humour. I'm glad for the opportunity that I can, you know, may not be everybody's sense of humour, but I'm glad of the opportunity to be silly in my own way on stage during the songs. And I'm enjoying that aspect of it. It really is quite fun being that sort of, hey, this is what my wife has to put up with.
Certainly have had fun with this this first song that you, I guess, was the first one you recorded as David Bowie?
Yes. I'd made about, I think, probably 5 singles with various bands before then, but this is the first time that I was David Bowie, and it was a really solipsistic piece of work about leaving home and nobody in the living room understands me and going up to London and that sort of thing. And it was called Can't Help Thinking About Me. But it was... the interesting thing about it, actually, is that it has chord changes in it that I still use to this day, so that there is some kind of through thing. Apparently so, there is some continuity in my songwriting. It owes an awful lot to The Who. The verse structure is, I think, fairly idiosyncratically mine. I'm surprised how many of the chords I still actually use today.
When it went down last night live, as you were introducing it, I thought that it was maybe just an exercise in nostalgia until I actually heard the song. And I'm thinking, this could have been on some wonderful garage band nuggets kind of garage psychedelia compilation, and it would have fit in perfectly. And where I was going with this a second ago was when for a person that changed the name so you wouldn't be confused with the Monkees' Davy Jones, the song can't help thinking about me. It sounds like a Tommy Boyce and Bobby.
That's interesting. I tell you, that really is interesting because it's not part of the, I guess, the English songwriting reference system. They really wouldn't, at that time, I don't think their songs really would have carried any weight in Britain particularly. So possibly, I don't know, would it have picked up on their influences somehow? Because mine would have gone back to a lot of soul and R&B and early British R&B type bands, like, as I say, The Move and The Who and those nature of bands, and they were pulling all their stuff out of rhythm and blues. So I think basically we end up going back to R&B. I think even a lot of those chord changes come from a lot of even Solomon Burke kind of things, you know. I know the F sharp minor is definitely a Solomon Burke nick that I made on from one of his albums. Sorry, Solomon.
Every time it seems like there is a new frontier, a new medium, you're not bashful about jumping in, whether it's rock as theater, whether it's rock video, and now the internet. The performance last night was actually on the web, right?
Yes. I think probably that stems from the fact that I was never completely sure when I was a kid what it was that I actually did and also what my ambitions were. I never could actually get a fix. I couldn't find a location for what it was that I did. As much as I admired artists who perceive music as being all of their life, everything they wanted to do was contained in the song and the performance. I felt there was, for me personally, I wanted to do something more, something broader, which brought in other art forms. And it mainly because I tend to take my, whatever my enthusiasms are, I do take into what's called work. So I was really into the theatre and I was really into paintings and sculpture and strange 30s and 20s films and the avant-garde and all these kind of periphery things in my life that actually made up the essence of my life. It's everything that I kind of live for. And I didn't kind of want to leave all those behind if I chose music to be my particular highway, the route that I was going to travel. So I tried as much as possible to bring those things into what it was that I did so I wouldn't ever have to leave my hobbies behind. And I never really lost that kind of curiosity, that kind of enthusiasm has stayed with me throughout my life. And I believe it's one of the reasons that I feel particularly active within my society in a way, is that I've never let go of actually what makes our society work and what are the components that it uses to express itself. And that's still a way that I perceive my life as being mirrored by those things that happened there. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense, and it's you're actually touching on something that I wanted to go into today in depth. So, since you opened that door, let's go down that path.
Okay.
Art and politics.
Mm-hmm.
Art and commerce. We touched on art and technology.
Mm.
Let's talk about art and politics. What artists? Boards, do you serve in an advisory capacity?
Okay. One, about 6-7 years ago, I was asked if I would go onto the board of an English arts magazine called Modern Painters. And I've been working not only on the board, but I've been doing some writing for them. I've done a lot of interviews, fairly extensive interviews, with some quite legendary painters, starting with Balthus, who's well into his 90s, right down to Damien Hirst, who is not in his 90s, who's one of our younger Brit Pack painters. Painters. Yes, he's a painter. He throws paint at canvas. And people like Jeff Koons, I've also interviewed, Julian Schnabel, Tracy Emin. I've done quite a few of those. So that really is sort of working in the sphere of a lightweight journalese. And then I started a publishing company because I got quite inspired by that. And so far we put out 3 books and we've got another few coming out over the next 12 months called 21, which really primarily its objective is to make available books on maybe more obscure British artists who... Because I got quite a thing about 20th century British art. I think a lot of it was very good and undervalued and never equated with being part of what was important in painting and sculpture in the 20th century, because the Americans led from the 40s, and before then it was the French and the Italians, and we never really got a look in. I think we did some really good stuff. So I'm quite jingoistic about that. And my objective is to make those artists better known. Available here. Yeah, that you can get them in the odd and obscure art shop. Actually, no, you can pick up a couple of them at MoMA, I think. Yeah.
What's the issue that New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani raised so loudly recently concerning art and America and how it's funded?
It was pure bunkum. His objective generally when he wishes to disestablish that the enemy seems to be to demonize them. And I think it was a very, really a Philistine move on his part. But it did what he expected it to do, which is give him massive column inches. But also, likewise, I also have to say the same thing for Charles Saatchi, who owns the work in that collection. I think he also played the game very well. Coming from advertising, he knew exactly what he was doing. Both sides won, as far as I'm concerned. I think they both got what they wanted out of the situation, which was generally to make aspects of their separate occupations very high profile, and they both succeeded. It's such an archaic argument. It just boils down to cartoons that were being drawn in 1908 when Picasso presented his first works that really stunned the public, I think. Is this art? You know, it's the same argument. It's nearly 100 years old now. You know, I think maybe the word itself is really not adequate for what it's supposed to describe. You know, I think the word art might also be archaic. Maybe it's just called, maybe it's just stuff. Maybe it should, the Museum of Modern Stuff might be, I think probably... You know, I don't know if it's art, but I'm not sure if that really matters. The thing is, it's great stuff, and it does something to me, and I read something into it. I don't care if you don't read something into it, but I do. Now, whether that's art or not, I don't care. The word art only matters to the ones who buy and sell it, I feel. I think the galleries and the dealers are very keen to keep currency in the word art, but I don't think for the rest of us we really need concern ourselves with the word art, because it has so many elitist connotations. And purposefully, I mean, it is kept into art performs in a very rarefied area. It's a strata that very few people have access to unless they're in with a particular in crowd, a particular way of reading modern writing or art speak, and have particular kinds of bucks to spend on it. That really isn't the way it should be. But that's where the money is. It is commerce for so many.
Is the timing and the emotional inflammation suspect on this issue?
Well, a few things are suspect on this issue.
You can't take on the economy.
No.
Along and we're having a hard time finding enemies, so I guess maybe someone had to invent one.
several things occur to me about it. One, I think it was insulting that the mayor never actually went to see the work himself. Chris Sofili has been one of my favourite British artists for quite some time. He works in an extraordinary fashion, and the elements that build up what he does are an interpretation of what it is like to be of Nigerian descent, living in England, being a Catholic and having gone through the English school system. There's a lot of relevance with the material that he was using, elephant dung, which I might add has been used by Afro-American artist called David Hammonds for many, many years. It's not a new deal. This is an accepted part of a certain way of working. And I think Giuliani was really more than non-perceptive about what actually was happening in terms of what the art represented to that particular artist. The argument that if I can do it, it's not art, I thoroughly agree with. I couldn't agree with him more about that. But there again, he's defining art as virtuosity. He's defining art as craft. And art hasn't been craft since the turn of the century. Craft is no longer all of what art is. Art is now a presentation of various symbols and images that become ciphers or doorways to a certain kind of perception. And prior to this century, art was a window that we looked out of and saw the world represented as we believed it really looked. It was windows for the whole of the 19th century, and bang, you hit the 20th century and it became doors. But people like Giuliani don't know that because they don't give a damn, because he's quite happy with Norman Rockwell, who's a perfectly good artist, but it probably begins and ends somewhere there. Or if he knows the name Van Gogh, then that must be art, because, you know, it's...
Is elephant dung?
Yeah. Depends on the elephant, I think. Well, as I said earlier, you know, there again, David Hammonds, the American artist, has been working with elephant dung for... it's not a new deal. And it's like sort of being brought up as though it's some new scandalous way of working that was done for a sensational effect. It's already part of a tradition that many artists are already tapping into and have tapped into for quite some time. And to the idea of using materials that aren't associated with art or the craft of art, it's not about oil paint anymore. It's about utilising the materials of the world. There are dirt artists, there are stone artists, there are acrylic artists and artists who work only in different kinds of plastics or new nuclear substances. And there are also artists who have been working for in body parts and in blood. And, you know, there's an artist in Britain who, in fact, is in the show called Mark Quinn, who made a sculpture of his own head from 8 pints of his own blood over the course of a year. He had the blood drained off and then froze it and had a cast made of his own head. And it's now in a little deep freeze box in the museum. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing, because you're looking at life and death and the components of the body in a static form all at once. And the effect of a one-to-one kind of observation of what's going on with this sculpture, it's quite an awe-inspiring condition. It really gives you a kind of an inside feeling of life and death. I mean, there's a lot of life-death confrontation in the exhibition. Actually, I find a lot of the work is Damien Hirst's work is all about death. Or the holding on to life desperately and the refusing to buy into the idea that we have to die. A lot of his work is based on that. I think a lot of the modern young artists, it really is part of the core of what they're trying to express. I do understand that. I think most artists, well, most people do. It's not just artists. I mean, it's most people. It becomes a deflected question, but it's a question that we keep going back to, is that when's it going to end for me, and what's around the next corner, and what is it I'm supposed to be doing here, you know, and the, and where did I come from? But that I honestly, I find the older that I get, there are fewer and fewer questions. It really does kind of boil down to those three, and having accepted there really is absolutely no answer to any of them. I think one gets more relaxed. That's what I'm finding anyway.
Let's talk about art and commerce, and certainly pop art, rock music. Give me your historical and cultural take, if you will, on how the UK and Western Europe and Japan have approached rock music in TV ads. Versus,
isn't that incredible? Yeah.
Well, I don't have the experience. All I know is that 10 years ago, if you wanted to get into a really lively debate with your peers, your American musician peers, just bring up the subject of whether or not it's okay to use Beatle music to sell Nike running shoes.
Yeah.
Rebel to sell cars.
Absolutely.
Something has changed. So first, let's
drastically,
let's talk about the cultural difference that you, being an international musician, would know much better than I, and that's the cultural background on the UK, Western Europe, Japan, as they approach this subject.
Well, I think from my perspective, what really happened... is that as much as we're loath to admit it, especially we in the rock writing area, I think, is that rock music has lost its currency as a subversive and revolutionary force. I mean, that was bound to happen because it happens with every art form. And I think when it merely becomes a conveyance for information, the conveyance itself is up for grabs because it's not exactly... what it is, isn't it? it could be put out to pasture now because it actually has done. If you think in terms of art, if you only think of art in terms of its revolutionary clout, its insistence on changing the establishment perspective, its way of unifying, creating solidarity within certain groups of people, then white rock has definitely come to a full stop in terms of being a conveyance of revolution. It's now merely a conveyance of information, which is fine, but it does mean that it no longer tweaks the ear the way that it used to. It doesn't make you feel as though you are us and them anymore. In fact, it's gone through its usual... It's been pulled into the tyranny of the mainstream, and it now just becomes a way that we... express our society in a very general, almost kind of conservative fashion. So it was bound to then get picked up by the advertising companies as being representative of society and, in fact, the establishment, and a way that we all think. It's very important for an art form to be the way that only a certain group of people think. That's when it's still an incendiary device. But when it just becomes the way that we all think, it's popular music. We all love popular music. Access to it is so easy. It's everywhere. It's wall to wall. It wasn't this, I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, I remember having to tune into the American Forces Network to hear any real kind of rock music at all, especially if I wanted to hear any soul or rhythm and blues. This was just nothing anywhere in Britain, unless you go to record shops that bought 45s off GIs and things like that and pick them up that way. So it's the pure accessibility of it as well. And I guess that would lead me to say that the internet, in fact, has taken the position that popular music used to have in that way. It is the revolutionary force now because it's unbridled, it's chaotic, almost anarchistic. You can't control it, however much people would like to. There is really no way of controlling the internet. There may be some very big sites up there, but there's a lot of real renegade, nutcase cowboy sites up there as well. So it really is the arena for expressing new ideas in a new way. And that's really, I think, what it's about, expressing new ideas in a new way. There are new ideas out there, although you have to look at a lot of pop music and see how formulaic it has become in certain areas. And because of the commercial aspects of that kind of formula have held the corporations into not nurturing artists anymore. They don't nurture talent. It's smack the big one fast because the artists are dispensable, but it's the formula that they hold on to. Not in quite such a colossal way as it's virtually the only way that the record industry is run these days.
Back to the cultural acceptance, past acceptance, you could actually sell hundreds of thousands of copies of the song if it got on a 30-second TV advert.
Oh, that certainly, that definitely happens. Still happens now, yeah.
10 years ago, it was just the sanctity of separation of this thing that Americans and held so high was that this music could never be used in commerce.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's changed. Why the difference culturally? And what's changed in America? I think you touched on the fact that the revolutionary aspect seems to make it tamer.
Mm.
Why was that never a factor in, let's say, Japan? Why was it just accepted for your music, Eric Clapton's music, Sting's music, to be used?
Well, I think, firstly, in Japan, there is no form of rebellionism. It just doesn't exist in quite the same way. It's not that so much, but the loyalty to first family and then to corporation. There was never really a particular generation in Japan that revolted against their peers and revolted against their parents. There was no sense of revolution. There was always a national pull to go somewhere all together. And you find even on the Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons in Tokyo, where you would go and see the crazies on the streets playing the music as greasers and turn-up guys or mad punks or whatever, they'd all close down at like 5 o'clock and get off their little stages and just all go home and have tea with their mother and father. And there was a real sense of togetherness. There wasn't the rebel thing. So popular music wasn't necessarily seen as a form of rebelling against anything. It was an exciting thing, yes. So it really was perceived in a very different way from the way it's perceived in the West.
Do you think anything in particular, Michael Jackson's administration of the Northern Songs catalog when he had it during the early and middle 90s for Beatles songs in TV adverts, or Bob Seger's multi-year Like a Rock Chevy Truck campaign, have those somehow knocked down some barriers or opened some doors? Or
well, that yes, I see what you mean in terms that they were first, but I think the zeitgeist was changing fast. I think it was okay to it's interesting what the Reagan and Thatcher years did to our nations in that way. A certain kind of acceptability for acquiring things and living a kind of a... It's left a yuppie disposition over everybody and everything. I think there's a very strong flavour of that with Britpop. I think you do see it with the Oasis and the Robbie Williams and I've Made Good kind of thing is really popular in Britain. He's a working class lad who's made a lot of money. It's kind of, that's cool. It really is, it's very acceptable to kind of be a success in that kind of, you know.
It's a very American sentiment.
You guys won then, didn't you?
I'll just say it doesn't sound foreign to us. You know, we're raised with that.
I think, you know, there's an incredible need for things to be looked at as though that there really is some kind of narrative form that we can all follow, and that there's some kind of successful resolve at the end of it. I look at the popularity of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, or it's just incredible that that thing has the highest rating of any show in America, just about.
And Tuesday night.
Yeah.
You were the correct answer.
I know. I saw it. Because like everybody else, I was watching it too. Because there's a bunch of nice people living out an American dream. And I think that, you know, that may have an awful lot to do with it. That there's some kind of nostalgia or kind of need to have the safety and the certainty of the idea that was put forward in the 50s that, you know, everything can be okay and we're all going to have a great time and be successful. And I think that really, because the more kind of chaotic and fragmented the actual foundations of our society becomes, I think the more that, in fact, that we'll see that kind of zeitgeist presented is that it's okay because really it's all going to turn back to this one day. But it ain't, is it?
let's talk about hours. And I've got to ask you, just because I've got you here, I've always noticed that in all the album titles for all the David Bowie albums over the years, there was one that had the title in quotes.
Yeah.
It was Heroes.
Yes.
I never had a chance to ask you that. And now Hours has...
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I know. I think it's a rather pretentious kind of affectation. It gives it the impression that there's a certain kind of knowing ironic stance taken to put things in apostrophes, you know. It's a bit like the two fingers either side of the word. And it's ciphering it, you know, it's putting it in graphic form.
It's taken that way too, by the way.
Yes, I think it is because it's the language of image. You know, I mean... I have to say that, you know, having been in advertising when I was a kid, I was what was called a junior visualizer, which is a fancy term for a commercial artist. We were kind of not only just doing paste-ups and drawings and actually doing the physical imaging of the ads, but I would sit in a lot on what the big guys upstairs were doing when actually formulating campaigns. And it was really interesting the way they used language and how they used image and how they combined the two. And I think that always stayed with me, is that how powerful those things are. And, of course, any basic painter, sculptor, knows that inherently. That's part of who he is. But I think to learn it from the outside is... I find it very interesting anyway, how those things affect people.
We're told by lots of the press that we're getting on you to support this new album, Hours, that you also are doing these independent service providers, the ISPs,
yeah.
on the internet for certain companies. And the New York Yankees?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I think my connection with baseball is fairly legendary. I mean, ask me who won the World Series.
I was about to say, however, but I bet you know the answer to this. In the most American of sports, baseball,
yeah.
During the World Series,
yeah.
Guess what song they used as they were on network television to exemplify being the best, winning the series. They played Heroes.
Yes, that's right.
I thought it was exceedingly hip.
That was
I thought it was exceedingly
talk
hip.
About fortuitous. Yeah, that was rather lovely. I actually do have a connection with baseball, however tenuous. When I was a kid, the area that I lived in, there were a whole bunch of Canadians who were expats. They'd stayed in England after the war. And they had married English girls and raised families and whatever, and virtually become some British. But they did keep up their baseball interest. And originating mainly from Toronto, they called themselves the Dulwich Blue Jays. And so I used to go to school with a kid of one of these guys, and he would play with his dad on the weekends, and he took me along, and I used to play in the, of course, I was put in the outfield. I think they found a special position for me in the outfield. Seemed to be four of us out there, if I remember right. But so I know my way around the mitt. I actually enjoyed it very much. It was a fun game. But I must say that is 14 years old, I think, is the last time I actually played baseball.
Well, you got your song on the World Series.
That was pretty good. But we started doing that. Well, I mean, I formed two things in 97. One was the BowieNet site. But that really was, I guess more than anything else, a flagship for the company called UltraStar, which is a company that does create ISPs, and I'm a founder of that company as well. And the idea was to, because we wanted every aspect of BowieNet.com to be as innovative as possible, and I think we probably created a really quite exciting artist site there with that. And I think because of the knowledge of that, got around the internet so fast, a lot of people were bringing their programs to us before anybody else, because it was almost coming to a point where you had to be seen to be part of it if you had something new in the music area. So it continued to be cutting edge, and it still is to this day. And we are going for a huge changeover in February of next year with some phenomenal new things on it. But that indeed has encouraged other people to come to the mother company, UltraStar, to start creating sites. That's how the Yankees came to us, and a number of others, Baltimore Orioles. So we're giving this tradition of baseball teams. We also have some football teams coming up and a few universities and whatever. And surprisingly enough, because it's kind of actually works in a smaller way than most ambitions on the internet, they are small, fairly intimate ISPs compared to a Netscape or something huge. We are still about the only people on the internet doing this kind of work, which is quite amazing. And if we're not, we're definitely the best known. So it's really becoming quite a player. The company is doing very well indeed.
I have to admit, I have to confess, that when I received the new album, Hours, with the associated insert talking about BowieNet and how to, become one with David.
Yeah.
I don't know. It hit me kind of, because I guess I'm still as I said, one foot on the platform and one foot on the train.
Yeah.
And because of my age and my experience. But it hit, I thought, certainly you have lent your considerable name and fame, and that you are being used as a commodity,
In this particular case,
I'm totally wrong.
No, absolutely not. In this particular case, well, two things to bear in mind. One, it's something that I'm extremely hands-on with. I mean, I dominate the site. It's all, everything about it is the way I want it to be. All the areas in it are the areas I want. I contribute to it all the time. I create the journals for it. I do book lists of things that I've read. I do. I also brought the Sensation exhibition to it for free. I mean, that's a free site that's within the BowieNet site. I've got a number of other art exhibitions that I'm running within it. I'm also starting to pull in on other artists and to introduce their work to other people, having them come on and do chat rooms. It really is becoming a much wider forum than when it first started, which has always been my idea, to expand it so that it represents all the arts, not just kind of the stuff that I do. Plus, we don't sell anything. We are not a sell site. You cannot buy a T-shirt on my site.
Really?
It's got nothing to do with sales. It's about trying to create an interesting, a new kind of community where the community revolves around a particular set of interests. And that's the idea of the ISPs, is to create a force that have like-minded ideas about something. That was that's the thing I found lacking when I was going to the more generic kind of ISPs when I got onto the internet. It's like, I wish there was something that really represented the kind of stuff I like. And I thought, well, if I think like that, then a lot of other people must think like that. well, let's try it with a one thing specific site. And as I know me best, it's to me. Let's see what happens. And it became a great success. There are a lot of other sites that deal with merchandise and selling and buying albums and all that. And I don't want to touch that because I don't think that's what I do best. What I do best is trying to create new ways of expressing things and trying to find new ways of combining information.
It's really interesting. Now, does that, having said that, does that reposition how you think, or maybe how we will think, of your rock art as far as a new album? For instance, this album, Hours. Having said what you just said, it now has possibilities far beyond going down to the record shop like we used to and buying the latest record.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my approach to how I think I can make a change in the way that music is conveyed to us. It's part of how we embrace the internet as a way of making it a fairly constructive exercise and not just a big shop, you know? It doesn't have to be a big shop. So much talk has gone about how music will eventually all be on the internet. Well, yes, but in what form? You know, I think it can't just become a replacement for the retail shop on the street. You know, because the retail on the shop on the street is actually a really good place. There's a lot of community aspects to that. A lot of kids go into those shops just because they want to be with some people. Absolutely, and that will never be replaced. But what will happen is that if the internet becomes very interesting in the way that it allows you access to music and the artists and what they think and what they do. I mean, we have chat rooms that I am in all the time on my site, at least 2-3 times a week. And I go in and I get feedback from everyone, and they're quite hostile as well. It's not a big pally. I mean, we're not talking the Osmonds. You know, it's not a fan club kind of thing. It's not like the old-fashioned idea of a fan club. This really is a sense of a virtual community. Of people that really have information that goes backwards and forwards between the artist and themselves. And that really is a totally new kind of thing. I've found very few sites where the artists are actually involved, where they'll go on and chat with the users of the site. And I think this is the way it should go. Hold on. And what will happen on the streets is that the retail system and the shop system will stay in place, but the shops that they're indifferent to you, the shops where there are lines all the time to the counter, where the guy behind the counter couldn't give a damn if you get your record or don't get your record, where it's never in stock, where they're not listening to you, those shops will fade out because the good shops that really want to give you service, they will stay, and it will, the whole system will be embraced with the internet as well. And selling will take place via the internet, but with retailers. And retailers more and more will be going online so that you get dual kind of service. You get a shop service and internet service as well. For maybe kids who can't get to the next big city, they'll be able to go online to their retailer and get it straight from them that way. It won't replace retail.
You just said something that is fascinating because I've been doing this almost as long as you have. And all of the greats have told me to a person, year after year, era after era, that they learned very early on that if they're going to have a career, that they cannot pander to the will of the audience or try to second-guess the audience and try to give the audience what they want.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, from what you just said, now I'm confused as to the value of the feedback if it's truly taken in by the artist.
Ah, I didn't say that I abide by any of the feedback. I'm very stubborn about what I like. I mean, if I disagree, it becomes more in terms of debates, and we will talk about, you know, that album sucks, and I say no, it doesn't suck, and this is why it doesn't suck. Yes, it does suck because it gets really quite juvenile. No, the feedback comes in, but I don't think that I would do anything other than what I usually do, which is go with my own personal needs about what I want to do. Absolutely. That would never change. Even the idea of putting this site together wasn't something that I thought the audience wanted. I just thought that once they heard it and saw it and got onto it, that they would really like it. And that's kind of the same approach that I've had with the music. If I do a new kind of album or a new kind of presentation, my presumption is I think this is exciting. There's got to be three people out there that also think it's exciting. And I went into the internet with the same spirit. I think the internet is incredibly exciting. And if I had my way, I'd do this. And so I did that. And it is exciting, enough people out there to carry on doing it. So it's, I never believe that. I think it's the same thing that I've, again, it's not, there's a real continuum here, I hope, that I never found there were parameters created around the art forms. I thought if you understood one, you understood them all. It's all about expression. And I do consider some aspects of the internet a new kind of art form, definitely a new kind of communication portal, which is indeed what most art forms are. And as I've kind of crept into the painting and the sculpture and to theatre and to and music and combining them all, I saw absolutely no reason to not continue that same line of thinking with the internet itself and just merely make it another kind of area that I can experiment with and recombine things.
I'm sure you've got a handle on it.
I think the worst thing you can do, see, on the internet is just try and take a shop and put it online. I think that that's not what the internet's about at all.
Not the first thing, but the second thing that happened
to me
was exactly that.
Oh, sure, yeah. But it won't be, yes, of course. I mean, there are certain sites that are nothing more than shopping malls, you know. But they don't, and then they're not really doing that great, you know. I mean, they go up and down like the breeze. Just selling stuff is not anywhere near the aspects of the internet that interest me. I think it's far more exciting than that.
Right. Talking about exciting. Let's talk about some of the songs on Hours. It was great to get to hear some of these live, and I hope folks that are listening got a chance to hear it either on the radio or on the internet when you performed it from the Kick Ass.
I think actually it will go out, if it hasn't gone out already, also on December the 7th, yeah.
Great. Tell me about Thursday's Child. It leads off the album Hours. You performed it live last night, and I found myself dancing with myself. Tell me about writing and recording Thursday's Child.
I think the first thing that occurred to me last night was that it's got a lot harder than it is on the album in terms of... I guess that's just live performance. It's inevitable that once you take a piece that was created really for a studio, or really didn't actually, wasn't created for performance, once you start working that thing on stage, it does go through quite a few changes. And I've noticed a lot of the songs have kind of hardened up since we started performing them. The four times that we've done them. But it's amazing. And, of course, the equation is made by the musicians themselves. You know, the musicians are slightly different from the ones that we used on the album. That always bewilders me how the transformation takes place from the recorded song to... And I'm quite happy for things to undergo those changes. I don't mind. I never tell my musicians to listen to the record and get it absolutely like the record. I've never done that. I always hope that there's some room for interpretation so that they have fun doing this stuff with me. How did it begin? Well, the people from this game, they're French people, Nomad Soul. I wasn't really a gamer. My son is. My son plays a lot of games, and he's pretty good at them. And when I was first approached by Nomad Soul people to write the music for it, I kind of said, you know, Joe, is it worth me doing this? You know, is there anything I should be? And he said, the only reason you'd like it is because you'd want to write something that hasn't been done before in that particular area. So why don't you go and explore it? And he came with me to see these people, and we went through it all. And really, my knowledge of it was Trent did some great stuff for the game Quake. But then when I started hearing the rest of a lot of gay music. It was all industrial and it was all hard-edged in that way. And I thought, well, interesting thing to do would be to create not a softer but definitely a more emotive kind of material, something that had more empathy with the kind of music that one would write for a soundtrack for a movie. And so I put it to these guys that if they would give me a really wide brief and allow me to do that kind of approach to it, then I would actually be quite interested in becoming involved. But I wouldn't want to do Earthling for them or something, which I was kind of, you know, a bit defensive when I went in because I thought they're going to want me to redo Earthling. I've done Earthling. I'm not going to do Earthling again, you know. So and they were absolutely very free with what I could do. And so Reeves and I went off and we wrote this kind of music. Because there is not a straightforward linear narrative in a game, it's very open-ended because it changes every time you play the game. And the expanse of the city and its inhabitants is so vast on this thing. I mean, it really is extraordinary. I think you can sit down in front of it for 200 hours.
200 hours?
Just to explore the city. It's phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. In fact, they're bringing out a version on PlayStation next year in February, and the Sony people are having trouble working out how to program all the relevant information for it. So they're going to have to create a new program for it because it's so vast. So, I mean, it really is quite exciting. It's got fantastic reviews in the game magazines. It's definitely up there. It's going to be one of the games of the year, which is... I'm glad I picked the right one. I was very pleased. But, I mean, I must say, when they first showed me, it was when they showed me the beta version, it was really mind-blowing. I thought, my, this is incredible. And I can kind of see where it's going to go. It's there's going to be a combination of principles from cinema and interpretive storytelling on the part of the user and a control of the user for what they're seeing and what they're playing, that will just, I don't know, for people who have an adventurous spirit, I think it will be really intoxicating to be able to take the lives and the narrative and the location and bend them at will in a virtual world that is so real that if you have one of those scope sets on with the earphones and the screen in front of your eyes, you really are going to be in a world that you have created and that you exist in. It's got to go that way. Whoa, the music. and I love the idea that they could take me. When I tell you what, they said, would I mind being portrayed in the game? And I said no. And they asked if Iman would do it. And she said yes. And a couple of the band members, Reeves and my bass player, Gail. So we're all in the game. And I said, where does it stop? I said, can you make me 24? And they said, yeah. So I'm 24 in the game. Blue-faced, but 24. That's so, you lose one, you win another. Yeah, you give up something, you get it. And then they said, so we have to do some motion capture work with you, you know, so we put all the things on you and you move about. And I said, hey, hold on. I said, I move okay. I said, but there's a guy that I've worked with in the past who's a choreographer of a dance troupe in Canada called La 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 Human Steps. We're an amazing dancer. Get him and capture his movements and put those on me. Can we do that? And then I'll be dancing really in a strange and incredible fashion. So they did that. They got Edward. Edward Locke, his name is. And he worked in the studio with him for a day or two. And they captured all his movements. So it's me at 24 with Edward's body. I mean, but it's... So that gave me the idea that it won't be so very long will I be able to stop doing videos entirely and just create this simulacra of myself doing virtually anything I want him to do. He'll always be 24 or 19 or whatever I want him to be. And I won't have to bother about actually wondering how you work with video in an MTV generation.
You're only half joking.
Oh, no, I'm very excited about the idea. I think it could be
possible, isn't it?
Absolutely possible.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely possible. In Japan, it's already happened. There's a pop artist over there whose name I can't remember, but she won't be offended because she doesn't exist. And it's so I could,
really?
Yeah, and she's a huge multi-million selling artist. She does commercials, she does videos, she's a virtual artist, and she's a teeny, a real teeny bop artist. I mean, you know, sort of one of those, that preference they seem to have for like 14, 15-year-old girls that sing very lightweight things. She's that kind of genre of artist, but she's mammoth, and it's just phenomenal. And I thought, well, to construct it more in the area of Tron. Do you remember Tron? Which now looks like a piece of prehistory. It is amazing how the speed, the rate of change has affected this. It was, it would have been 70. It was quite early, wasn't it? It was actually in the 70s. It was a 70s movie. And I only,
it was even later than that.
Maybe early 80s, do you think?
Yes.
I do remember one thing about it, which is I turned it down. I turned it down, yeah. Yeah, probably because I was working on something. Because I think it must have appealed to me, but I may well have been touring or something like that.
I think you were on Serious Moonlight Tour, because I think the movie was around 84.
That may well have been it. Yes, that would have been probably the reason that I wouldn't have been able to do it. But looking back at it now, it really looks, it's so naive and vulnerable looking, and you can't believe that they actually thought like that then, that that would be the be-all and end-all of computer gaming. It's got its own little history built into it now. It's just incredible. I've got friends who collect Simon Says, and do you remember Pong? And they have those collectors, and they have them now in glass cases.
It's like Pez.
It's yes.
They're collecting those.
Well, Pez, interestingly enough, was the reason for eBay on the internet. The guy, his wife collected Pez containers, Pez dispensers, and he was trying to find them on the internet. And realized that it was, if there was some kind of service that would kind of supply this need. And it all came out of that. Because of his wife's need for Pez dispensers. She apparently has one hell of a collection
I
there.
I guess so. I guess so. Here's a recent quote that I found to be quite profound. The 70s. We're the beginning of the 21st century.
Yes.
How so?
Yeah, I really believe that.
What indication?
Well,
do you see?
Again, most of it, I guess. I think that more than anything else, that the idea of, for me as a member of society, I think for me it felt like an era. A decade when absolutes were breaking down, there was the feeling that things were pluralistic, that the hard and fast rules that we'd sort of, the spin of the 50s where everything was answerable, where there was good, there was bad, there was negative, there was positive, that everything was easy to quantify and easy to put into categories, broke down in the 70s. There was suddenly a feeling that there were at least two sides to every question. There was ambiguity actually became part of society. The whole sexual revolution really reached a point in the 70s where nothing was seen as being quite so clear and straightforward as it was before. Everything started to the beginning of the recognition that we live in chaos really started in the 70s. I think the Nixon and the Vietnam conclusion at that point, that the duplicity of what war was all about really came home more than at any other time during that period. It really felt like a new century. The 60s were a coda to the rest of the century. There was like the questions were raised then, I think, in the 60s. But still there was a kind of an idealism which in itself had its own absolutes and its own belief that there was an answer to particular things. And I think the 70s showed conclusively that we live on a thread of rationality, then in fact the cosmos is far more complex and non-understandable than we had ever perceived before, that everything we knew was wrong.
Just about.
I think one has a personal morality, but that's a different thing from a universal consensus. And the universal consensus is that we are expanding and diminishing at the same time. I mean, I think the push and pull factor has really came home in the 70s. It really, for me, felt like the new era had begun then.
Besides the fact that you're at the middle of them, the period when you've recorded the Diamond Dogs album, you're, I'm told, literally on tour in America, and I don't know if there's a, you have some downtime, or there's a break in the tour, or you make a break in the tour. You tell me, but there is a remarkable shift in your approach to everything musical that you're doing then. And it's profound. It's affected popular music ever since you've done it. And we know the nuts and bolts of going to Philly and Sigma Sound, but no one's ever told me why, so I thought I'd ask you.
Again, I think it's about this general, rather obsessive enthusiasm I have for things. Being on the road in America during that period, I had American music secondhand, like all us English gits. It was on the radio. It was, if we were lucky enough to play a GI bass, then we could buy 45s, or they gave, I had very generous contacts I made there that would give me rock records and R&B and soul stuff that we just couldn't get in England, you know. I mean, the first thing we had to do in England, of course, is because we had American 45s, is to find the spider to put in the middle, you know, because the... yeah, we had a little thin spindles, yeah, yeah. We didn't have the ones that, with the big hole in the middle. So that was the first. It was finding spiders to play the 45s with. Otherwise, you were standing there trying to get it right on the turntable, line it up with the rims on the rubber. It was like... so I think, actually, it was very hard for us to actually perceive that the music that we were listening to was associated with our lifestyle. Very naive, but true. It just came out of space. Sure, yeah. This stuff came from America. Well, all this stuff happened, you know, and America is where... And I think coming to America, the impact of that, this was a real tradition, this was a real music coming from a way of life and a lifestyle, actually really came home in full force. And I got completely overwhelmed by it, as I usually do by new things, or new experiences, not new things by any means, but new experiences. And I was just swept away with it. And I wanted to soak it up and then express it my way. Which is generally what I kind of find that I do, you know, with enthusiasms. They all go in and then they all come out from the point of view of a kid from South London. So that's sort of in a nutshell is what happens, I think.
What, the transition that you made was not subtle. It was overt. It was headline grabbing in the rock press. It had not just a musical component, but it had a personnel component. It had a fashion component, a visual component. You went from rock theater to a much more, shall we say, sparse or musical presence?
Yeah. Oh, that well, that again was, I still wasn't at a state where I felt comfortable particularly. In fact, any way, shape or form was I comfortable with myself being a performer. I think it comes from, I mean, I just had to use characters to portray the songs and the ideas that I had. And I rarely did an album that just was a collection of songs. There was always, even in my mind, a sense of narrative behind the 12 or 14 songs. There was a sense that there was some thematic tie. And I had in my mind characters and a storyline and a city, a location. It was a novella. Each album was an attempt at a novella of some kind. And my need was to portray one of the characters or the protagonist or the lead character in that particular thing on stage to interpret those songs. And it partially became because I enjoy theatrical music. I enjoy the idea of interpreting things on stage and creating an otherness of some kind, creating another kind of world, and partially because I had huge unease with myself as a performer. I never believed that I was much of a performer or a singer or anything in that way, and I had to do these songs out of necessity. That's kind of what started it, in a way. When I was in my late teens, it was my considered opinion that what I would inevitably end up doing was writing a kind of musical. I thought that's what I was going to be doing. I thought I would be writing musicals and other people would sing them. But nobody sang my songs. So it really, I had to go out and sing them. And the best way of me doing them is kind of thinking, I guess, well, if this were a musical, it would be kind of like this. And then it was easier, much easier for me to be able to do the songs in character of something that I'd written, and keep that in the front of my mind. It got easier over the years, and I guess somewhere in the 80s I found my own voice, so to speak, which seems to be about half a dozen voices. But as I do kind of move up and vacillate from style to style, if it suits a particular song, you know, I still think of myself as merely another instrument to sort of, you know, express these pieces of music. It's not me interpreting songs in a way. It's a strange dichotomy. I really am quite still as confused about what I am as a performer as I ever was. I'm certain of myself as a writer, but as a performer, I don't know. I haven't got a clue.
And when you made this distinct left turn, I don't know. I never did hear the particulars of how did you part company with Mick Ronson and that band? And how did you draft an entire new band, mid-tour, mid-career?
Yeah, let me see. How did that really happen? I think that I just went out on a limb and sunk the whole operation because I had this terror in my mind that I was going to be trapped with Ziggy and the Spiders as...
That early?
Oh, yeah. I knew then. And there was no way that I was going to be trapped inside that character as being the rest of my life. I have an incredibly short attention span. Once I've completed something, that was really interesting. I enjoyed doing that a lot, but shouldn't we be moving along now to something else? You know, this is getting a bit tired, you know? And I didn't. I just didn't want to do that. Mick also wanted, I know, very much to have a career of his own, and indeed, he did have a fairly successful career when he first left me with a couple of albums that he made. But I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I would do once I'd done. I mean, I really sort of painted myself into a corner by finishing Ziggy and the Spiders. And in a way, that is also a freedom because it meant that I had everything and nothing all at the same time. And I just think things evolve from that. But it made me aware that that really was how I had to deal with things in the future every time, is that once I'd finished with a character, I should finish it and then move on to something else. And it just became a pattern of work right through to the early 80s when I had virtually stopped. I guess there was a process where I became more comfortable being myself on stage, and the need for characters just became less and less.
You have learned that lesson well and been very consistent about.
Oh, thanks so much, Eric.
I want to make sure he finished his line. Does that go on for 30 minutes? Okay, great.
Ah, thank you.
Do you?
Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Good. I have a quick chocolate.
We'll just close out the doors until we're done.
Fantastic.